Welcome to the Truth to Power Show on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm your host, VJR Nathan. And I'm here with Jessica Mehta as a co-host. Welcome, Jessica. Can you hear you? You're muted or no? Go ahead. Just say hello.
You hear me this time?
Yeah, I can hear you. Okay,
Okay.
great. We're back online. All right, great. So, welcome. It's February 13th, but we're airing a little later in the month. Let me just pull up the bio. We're here with Amelia Diaz Ettinger. Amelia is a was born in Mexico and raised in Puerto Rico. Amelia Diaz Ettinger writes poems that reflect the struggle with identity, often found in immigrants. She began writing poetry at age 3, dictating poems out loud to adults in her life who wrote them down for her. Ettinger has continued writing poems and short stories throughout her life while working as a high school science teacher. In 2015, her first book of poetry, Speaking at a Time, was published by Red Bat Books. Ettinger lives in Somerville, Oregon. Welcome, Amelia.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
Thank you so much. You know, the first thing that strikes me was that you began writing poetry at age 3. It's quite a young age to start writing poetry. And tell us a little bit about, like, how, you know, maybe if you remember how that impression of poetry has changed over the years. You know, do
Oh,
you
sure.
remember being that age and how that impression, you know, poetry formed in your mind at a young age or even growing up, and then how it's evolved over the years?
Oh, yeah. When I was really little, I think 3 and 4, I used to spend a lot of time in front of the television, which is not necessarily good for development, but it was wonderful for vocabulary development, actually. And there was a show, the noon show. And the show at noon, where we were getting ready to have lunch, which was a 3-hour affair, there would be poets on the show. Nicolás Guillén was one of them. Luis Páez Matos was also in there. And they were very rhythmical and very onomatopoeic. And so my first poetry, when I was be inspired, Papi, Papi, I have a poem. Write it down right now. You know, get the whole household crazy trying to find a piece of paper, because I was a dictator at the time. That was an autocracy, and I was a dictator, right? And I will come up and have a very rhymey poem. Unfortunately, all of those poems got destroyed in a flood years later when I moved to Pullman. But there's only one that I remember by heart, and it's actually kind of a cute poem, very rhymey, and nothing to do with my personal reality. And I think so how poetry has changed is, as a child, it was poetry of pure imagination, versus as an adult, the poetry that I work on now is a poetry that tries to search for some answers. And there's more impetus that is from the outside than the pure charm of a child writing poetry that comes totally from the inside. What was that?
Can you share the poem that you remember?
Oh, sure, I can. Una estrella brilló en el cielo con tanto y tanto esplendor, que cuando la gente la vio, todo el mundo se asombró. La estrella se cayó y una niñita la recogió, mas cuando en sus brazos la vio, una muñeca se devolvió. As you can see, it's very end rhymey. It's all the O-O-O-O, which actually, if I analyze it, it's not a bad idea to end in an O, because it's a poem of being astonished, right? There's a star that falls off the sky, and this child picks it up, and it becomes a doll in his hand. So it's astonishment, like, whoa! So, but, you know, those things are so unconscious, even a 4-year-old. which I think still happens to all the poets. They once they look that stuff in the paper and you go, was that what I was writing about? Oh, I get it now.
Yeah, I don't have it memorized, but I do have a poem when I wrote when I was six, and I just know it was called The Rose. So I'm sure it's also along those lines. Dr. Seuss inspired.
Yeah, it sounds like we get into the form very much as growing up. But when we're first introduced to poetry, the form and the hits of the rhymes sounds like we're always fascinated with as a poet. But as we mature as poets, I find we get more into the message. We get more into the meaning than
Right.
necessarily the payoff of a rhyme. Yeah, and I see now how many you mentioned a few other books you few of the books, the themes in the books that you published. I have them here. Another more recent book was called Dissection. In Self-Dissection, the author takes an anatomical journey through the physical body to find answers about heritage, environment, family, and the nature of being as an immigrant. These poems in these pages are written in crisp pen, like an anatomical text, yet still allow the lyrical and metaphor to scrape the surface of the physical reality that is underneath, the ethereal something that is often hard to embody. Really amazing description here, given by the publisher, I assume, or yourself. The Poetry Box published it. Can you tell us a little bit about how the body, embodiment, a little bit of that process of, they could use the word atomical. Can you talk a little bit about that? Yeah.
My son is a professor of anatomy, and we were talking a lot along the lines of where you express some of your most intimate feelings. And it has something to do with the way I was talking, and he was saying, you're so expressive with your hands. It's almost like your hands are always trying to reach out for the words. And that conversation with my son led me to think, oh, I can make a collect all my poems that have a body part and see what is that poem conveying. I realized I had a whole series of poems that dealt with a body part, like my face, my hands, my viscera. And it was interesting to me to see what was conveying in those poems, like the acceptance of self in the first poem of the chapbook is accepting the reality of your face. It might not be the face you want, might not be the face you like, but it's the face you have. So there is an acceptance there. And it was really interesting for me to put it that way. Because when I came to the hands, I realized that I associate hands with womanhood, with being not a creative spirit, but just being a woman. And I think it's because all the kindness that I receive growing up were women that dealt with textiles. And it was that charm in the way that they care to pass that knowledge that made that connection, that made that connection of not only with them, but to the love of needle and thread, to the love of creating something that would protect somebody like a coat or make somebody feel pretty like a beautiful dress. So there's different places in your body that I think that you can express or find the true meaning of who we are. Does that even make sense what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, no, I got it. It's interesting. Both the descriptions talk about heritage and being an immigrant and family, as you mentioned a little bit about with your son and the connections between family. If you can expound a little bit about the heritage and the immigration experience, immigrant experience, and we could go from there. Like that'll be a great way to embody what you were saying just now. Like the immigrant experience is really important to your work, it seems like.
Yes, absolutely. A lot of I think because being displaced, I mean, I was displaced from my country of origin by a crime. I was stolen. I was stolen from Mexico and taken to Puerto Rico. And there is always, and then I left Puerto Rico at age 17. Well, actually, I was closer to 19, sorry. I was 19 when I finally left for. And there is always that sense of displacement, which is not unique to definitely to me, but I think is the kind of displacement that I know a lot of Puerto Ricans feel when I talk to them about that connection that they have with something that is more than the food, more than the music, more than the neighbors that come in the afternoon to see what you're making for dinner. It's the whole fabric, the whole connection of feeling displaced. And consequently, I think a lot of us stay looking for home. And I think my poems show that I'm looking for home, which is, I think, typical of most immigrants.
You'd want to answer that, but I'd love to hear more about you being stolen as a child from Mexico. And this comes from being an Indigenous person as well. Obviously, you and I, Mexico, what we call Mexico and what we call the United States, is a colonial border that separates us. And with the murdered and missing Indigenous women, obviously encompasses those in Mexico as well, but there's this, superficial divide that doesn't encompass Mexican women and girls.
Yes, and I always wonder, I mean, even the terminology, Native American, right? But if you are from, like, my mother is mainly Mayan, that term doesn't apply to her. She's indigenous. So there is all these terms that want to separate us and make us look fractured, when in reality, we have the same quill running through our veins, right? We're still connected. And and that brings me to when I was taken to Puerto Rico by my fa father's family, my indigenous part was denied to me. Not only in the form of my mother, but in the form of, we cannot speak of that. You're white. You're not anything but white. And it was like, okay, but I look at see myself in the mirror. And I don't look like you guys. I'm not blonde and blue-eyed. I have these cheekbones. I have this mouth that define me. And that was like a no-no. You can't go there. That's not a good position to be in. So there is also that place of looking for home is there too.
Yeah, home is such an important part of our identities, being belonging, and one of the lines in the description of your book, Le Learning to Love a Western Sky, it talks about the book being a transition from nostalgia to integration, and the review of aging, loving, and betrayal in this foreign home. It's really interesting how nostalgia and integration sounds apropos to what you were saying, like kind of like finding one's own face, finding one's own identity, and moving away from a stark contrast between idealism and its opposite as to integration. So you can talk a little bit about that and like tell us a little bit of flesh that out, that line out a little bit more. That'd be great.
I think integration finally dawned on me when I realized how much I love the Western sky. I mean, I will always love the Puerto Rican toady for its beauty and size, this little tiny bird. I miss the beaches, yes, but I also, if somebody moved me out of Oregon, I will miss the blues. I will miss the flickers and the Stellar's Jam that make a ruckus outside. I realize how much in love I am with the nature that I have been so fortunate to live in. That integration is part of my makeup too. And I will never be considered an Oregonian, even though I have lived here all of my adult life.
We are very protective of that title.
And I wonder how long does it take to be considered from one place? Because this is the interesting part that I always think is kind of funny, ha ha. I was born in Mexico, but the Mexicans don't consider me Mexican. I live in Puerto Rico, but I was always like, oh, you're the Mexican girl. Okay. So I live in Oregon for most of my life. I mean, I live in Mexico for 4 years. I live in Puerto Rico for 16 years or 15 years. And I live here ever since in Oregon, in the Pacific Northwest. And it's like a lot of me is the blues. A lot of me is the Palouse. A lot of me is the Oregon coastal range. But it's like Peter, right? The rooster crows three times and he's denied all three. So I feel that way.
Yeah, it's interesting how sometimes people will say that often used phrase, go back to where you came from. It's an often used phrase by some people. And it's interesting, like even for myself, like, I was born in Staten Island, New York, and still people will say that to me, even though just because I'm brown, like go back to India. I mean, like India is like a foreign country, very foreign to me. So in India, when I talk, I sound like an American. So of course, many BIPOC communities members will go through that experience of displacement, even if they're born in the area that they're living. People will just look at the skin color or the outward appearances and make judgments. And unfortunately, that's a sad reality of this country that they make judgments based on just appearances.
Right. And I have this accent that immediately opens the door to otherness. You know, it's like I live here and I live here forever. Oh, where are you from? So I would say, oh, I just we moved from LaGrande, and they go, no. Before that, I go, oh yeah, I used to live. I tried to be obtuse. Oh yeah, we used to live in Pullman. Now, what's the population of the town where you live now?
102. Yeah. It's an interesting community. I mean, there is a lot of help in this neighborhood. My house was threatened by fire. We don't know each other very well. People keep to themselves, but my house was threatened by fire when about the third year that we moved here, and it was amazing how all the neighbors came in and helped me start moving things. My tractor, the important things that we wouldn't be able to replace. So it's talking about integration.
And one of your books, These Hollowed Bones, that was, well, I think most recently published, April 2nd, 2024, was published by Sea Crow Press. It reads, in these hollow bones, birds are a conduit for the conversations of internal emotions and the natural world. This collection ties together the themes of loss, marriage, and ecology, topics that are, at once personal and universal. These voices contained within the poem speak of the isolation felt by both avian and human. It's really interesting, avian and human, due to migration and loss of habitat, loss of home. Nature and bird lovers will find solace and self-recognition within these pages. Really interesting how you were able to connect your experiences with the migration of birds. And tell us a little bit about that process. And maybe you can read a poem from this collection if you'd like.
Sure. My training from university was as a my master's degree was an or in ornithology, so I have been working on birds even before I left Puerto Rico. My first job was identifying and finding several different species of birds throughout the island. So that the birds have always been an integral part of the way I see the world. As a child, maybe it was more an escape route of imagination with seeing their flight. And now, with having spent so much time in the last, I would say, 8 years reading a lot of eco poetry, I realized, let it go. Start talking about your identification with my avian friends. And so and that's what I did with this manuscript. I decided for 2022, I sat down every day and tried to write a poem about a bird. And it was by randomly chosen. I opened my field guide and said, okay, this bird. And I go, oh yeah, I really, and then I realize how I have always identified some birds, either with myself, with the people I love, or just identifying them as, like, I talk about a ruddy duck as a circus clown because they are kind of funny, especially when they are out of the water. And I don't know, there are some connections that we always make, right? With nature. So, like, I think of myself more as a house wren than anything. You know, they're little and they make an awful lot of noise. House wren. And this was during the pandemic. House wren. Turdoides avian. To have so much in common with a brown bird, especially now during this pandemic. She and I, cave dwellers, troglodytes that gnaw at seeds, insects, and time. She awaits her brood to grow and fly away, while I long for my children to return to this garden to play and forage. We bide our lives in this same meadow. She, a gifter songster that gurgles and stutters, while my voice rises in bursts of silent loneliness. We let each other share the side-by-side communion. Her black eyes, I my own, as I near her wooden house. Over the fence of my garden, her tail cocks a wave. I say hello with the two fingers at my temple, the grace between neighbors. As I nibble an apricot, she feasts on a moth, and we dream of company soon.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank
Thank
you, thank you.
you.
I really appreciate how you make connection. There's so many of us in the modern world, in this modern Western world, turn a blind eye towards nature and animals. But I think it's really great, even just making that connection, making that congress, making that communion is really important to model, so we can all kind of see with eyes, our brethren in the animal world. And not like, so much in New York are like focused on the rats and the cockroaches rather than the birds and the beauty, So really beautiful. But I just also wanted to shout out, this is Radio Free Brooklyn. We're here with I'm your host, Vijay Nathan. I'm here with Jessica Mehta and Amelia Diaz Ettinger. Radio Free Brooklyn is a 501c3 nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a free and open platform to our community for literacy, education, and free expression. So we rely primarily on donations from listeners like you and supporting local artists. So if you'd like to support our mission, continue to bring us quality community radio, we invite you to make a one-time donation or monthly pledge at readyforbooklyn.org/donate. You can donate as little as $1, and every cent continues to help us stay on air. So please help independent community radio by pledging whatever you can afford And remember that RFB is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, so your contribution is tax deductible to the Folk Central Law. Again, that's readyforworking.org/donate. What else is coming up for you in regards to the, you published several books and how you approach the different projects, drawing out a different aspect of your lineage and your biography, of your life story, how you approach your different projects and decide, all right, I'm going to focus on this today, or do you go by the publisher, or do you go by your own instincts and what's coming up for you?
My own instincts. I don't approach a pub. I am not good at approaching publishers. I'm using kind of the dart method. Throw it and see where it sticks. I have been really, really pleased with the people I have worked with, and got to meet some wonderful poets like our co-host.
The Early Press, which is a nonprofit collective press here in Oregon.
Oh, the early press, right? Okay, great, great. Yeah, we talk a little bit about that. Tell us a little bit about. Also, you guys can share a little bit of how you connected through Early Press.
So Early Press is a nonprofit collective, and basically the accepted poets serve a 3-year term as editor slash publisher. So I think I was 1 year ahead of Amelia, 1 or 2, 1 year, right? And so I was part of the small cohort that selected her manuscript, Learning to Love a Western Sky.
Nice.
It's a very unique experience to go through scores of manuscripts and select what we deem the best, and then get to work with, and I don't think work is quite the right word, just build this community with that. It's different than the typical publisher poet relationship.
What was your experience of it, Amelia?
It's
That's
To,
it.
it continues. I mean, even though I have not been an editor for 2 years, the connection with the press stays there. I volunteer when they need somebody to do a MC for some function or read manuscripts. Is that it becomes it is my poetry family. And I have made some really anchored friendships within the press. I mean, I consider Jessica a dear friend. And so does Brittany Corrigan and Connie Soper. It's just been wonderful. And we continue to share our, even though we're not connected to the press anymore, we can continue to share poetry with each other, make presentations around the state and outside the state. So it was and it continues to be a wonderful experience. Yeah, I have been really grateful for all of the small presses that I have been grateful to be published with. Not only that I meet fantastic people, they continue to be very supportive of my work.
Great, great. And also, I noticed in your bio that living in Eastern Oregon, you have two dogs, two cats, and way too many chickens, which I think is
Yes.
really interesting. Tell us a little bit about like your experience. Like, now, are you living like in a farm type area, or is how do you get?
It's more of a forest area. I think a lot of people have a tax deduction for the number of trees that they have, and here if they maintain it, some of them actually have a part of this forest for lumber. We're not one of them. We're preserving our acreage for a natural habitat, and it's been wonderful here. I have just about every species of woodpecker there is in Oregon is here in this acreage, and There's not any longer two cats, unfortunately. We're down to one cat. And the chickens has been reduced in numbers too, because we do have quite a few predators around, which they need to eat too.
If you could tell us also a little bit of the influences, like, because you've been writing for such a long time, your whole life basically. Who have you read that really kind of gave you an inspiration or guided your development? Who are some authors you read that maybe guided your development, or even some artifacts you want to call out as being like in any genre?
I have been really blessed by always having the opportunity to have some sort of connections with wonderful writers. Growing up, like I said, I listened to Pales Matos and Guillén on the television and in person. I mean, we got to see them in person performing, and they were definitely my first approaches to poetry. My dad really liked a lot to read a lot of poetry, so the books were available. And later in life, I think Neruda was the one that was forbidden to be used in my house because my dad considered him too dangerous because he was a communist. So we were not allowed to have him in the house. So of course, as a teenager, he was a main influence. I was going to grab every Neruda. I had Lorca, Neruda, and then when I moved to the States, I think it was Mary Oliver, Louise Chiffon. How do I pronounce? I always say her name wrong. Louise Chiffon. Chiffon. How do you say it, Jessica?
Don't ask me. She'll probably gonna be better than I am.
Currently, there's so many people that I read and enjoy that I couldn't even, I would feel that I would leave names out. But those were big building blocks as I was incorporated into this life.
That's great. And I'll just do another quick announcement. It's really interesting to hear like what people are reading and what's influenced them over the years. I just want to do a quick announcement. For Ready for Brooklyn, just to interrupt this conversation one quick second. We're gonna be airing on February 25th at 7 a.m. When we air. But for those of you listening on the time of the airing, a few days later, Wednesday, February 28th at 8 p.m. will be the night of music that's brought to you in collaboration with Music Center Trivia Night, as well as Ready for Brooklyn and the Shuffle. Whether you're a musical aficionado or just looking for a fun night out, this event is for you. Gather your friends, assemble your dream team, and get ready to put music to knowledge to the test. The month's theme is all about love. So secure your spot, head over to Instagram, and find us at the underscore shuffle for the sign-up link. Tickets are $5. Mark your calendars and set the date for February 28th at 8 p.m. Star Bar is where the music happens, and we hope to see you there. Speaking of that, is music a part of your life, and to what extent do you find yourself listening or influenced by musical tunes, or in your poetry, do you find yourself having a little bit of a rhythm or a little bit of a sense of musical construction there? Any music you listen to from your country or from around you in the country music, anything you're exposed to that how music has influenced you?
Yeah, absolutely. This came out in my last reading. Somebody said, because my poems don't have a lot, they don't have a lot of, they have no outside ending rhyme, right? There is all internal rhyme, but there is a cadence. And one of the people in the audience is a musician, and he said something, I don't know music, so I didn't understand what he said. But basically what he was referring to, that there was a cadence to my poems. And when he described it, I realized, yeah, it has a lot of the Caribbean rhythms. And I think that even though I write in English, I think that music that I listen to is mainly all Latin American music. And I think those rhythms do show up in the way that I break down sentences, the number of syllables there are in the sentences. They do form a pattern, and which I was not aware of it, but now when I read my poems aloud, I do hear it. I'm beginning to, yeah, there is a little bit of reggaeton there. There's a little bit of salsa. There is a little bit of rumba. And I think it is inevitable because I always have the music on in my earbuds, right? So you listen to a little music and then you think of something you want to write down, and those rhythms do meander into your subconscious.
Thank
We can
you.
hear you.
You can't hear me?
It comes in
Okay.
and out, but hopefully we'll, yeah.
I don't know what's going on. I was going to ask, why do you think you only or mostly write in English for poetry?
Because I no longer use Spanish, and it's, I don't have any friends here in Eastern Oregon that speak the language. I only speak Spanish when I talk to my Puerto Rican friends, and that's not very often. We get together on the phone maybe two or three times a month. So I'm thinking in it. Well, I don't even think in English. I don't think I think in words. I think it's just a series of spells. I don't know. But I don't spend in my family. My daughter speaks a little bit of Spanish, but it's more comfortable to just talk in English because she's still learning the language. So when I come to the board to sit down to write, it's almost like Spanish has abandoned me.
That's interesting. Like, and when we talk about, one of the lines from the poem is about the intimacy with self, I think is to quote yourself. Do you feel like you're continuing a conversation with maybe the prior self that was more fluent, was speaking in Spanish, and the current self, which is more comfortable in English? And how do those two sides of you, congrats. I think we gave a hint to it by saying, that you're thinking more in images, the magic spells. You give a little hint towards that with the spells thing, with the spells insight. If you could expand a little bit on that and how that connects the three, that trinity within yourself, maybe that part of you that speaks Spanish and the part of you that speaks English, and that spell casting that's maybe bringing them to the two together.
That's a really interesting question that I'm not sure that I know the answers to it. I think that's part of what probably drives some of us to write is trying to understand those intercepts that are they're deep within our neurons, but we're not quite sure how they're connecting. I mean, some things scientifically we know, for example, in language. Once you start integrating that second language into your makeup, you start dreaming in that language, right? And everybody talks about that experience when they start have the first, usually it's a nightmare. There is a confusion between the languages. I mean, yeah, I remember going through that when I moved first to the States. But then there is a moment where you realize that thoughts are not even in Spanish or English. Thoughts are there. Not necessarily with the body of a word. And I don't know how to explain that, except I think that happens more often than we as scientists know. I like to consider somebody like Helen Keller. She didn't have the words as we know words, right? But she was thinking in a stream that might not have that material body of words as we know it. And I think that happens when you have integrated two languages that are almost inseparable.
That's so interesting about language. My mentor, Rick Jarrow, who was talking to me in a previous episode, talked about the person, the late Rick Jarrow, he just passed on. But he just said, show me the person who's gone beyond language. I'd like to have a word with him, which I thought was a funny little quip. Kind of like talking about how can we go beyond language? Because ultimately, we're sitting in Congress with people and so much of our communion comes from language, but a really interesting perspective of, and then it becomes the idea of, the movement in the world to like make everyone speak English, and to what extent the cost of that, the burden of that, unification is that in English, is that so much, to what extent do you find yourself at the limit of expressing yourself, expressing the thought? Does English have a limit where you can like, you realize I have to use at least one or two words in Spanish, and whether or not you still do that.
And I do. When I get to writing something where I sit down and write a poem, actually the very first poem in Learning to Love a Western Sky was because of that. I was thinking of the word patria. And it was a word that is beyond our concept in English, because I know how it feels when I say patria in Spanish, but when I try to translate it in English, it doesn't have the same emotional quality to it, regardless if I was whatever nationality I was. Patria describes something that is much more, that encompass more than maybe a nation or homeland. And that's what the first poem, and I don't want to read the whole thing, but just to give you an idea, I wrote it as a letter. My dear beloved, describe patria, homeland too formal, country no warmth, but patria is family, food, colorful hands. I shudder naming your towns. And I think that that's what that was about. That poem was about where you find the language to integrate that, to show it in English. This would be what I want to say, that this is the small word brings to the forefront for us that speak the language.
That's so much that, and I mean, it suggests that English is severely limited in another language, even in my tribal language, Swahili. It's like, well, I guess the closest thing is this in English, but it means so much more. Or with Hindi, it's the same thing. And my kids are in Spanish immersion school, and I'm already starting to like see that with them. I wonder if there's any words in English where it's inverted, where it's like, well, this is it in English, but it's so much more that you can't translate it.
I'm sure they are, and that would be a fun little exercise for us to work on in the next poem.
Yeah, and I
To find a
suspect
word.
like Black culture has influenced English so much. Slang terms and these kind of idioms from Black culture are something that can't be translated anywhere else. And I think that America needs to acknowledge that, African Americans have contributed so much towards the American culture that, when we talk about the jazz and blues, all that kind of thing. And so again, it speaks to the BIPOC experience more broadly, but the lack of props to like the BIPOC experience and the impact it's had in American culture. I suspect that would be one of the primary ways in which English has evolved and changed over the years, But I also want to talk about briefly about the covers. This can be released on YouTube, but you have the cover here of the body for self-dissection and the different flowers underneath, and just talking about image and how image, visual arts and the image may scaffold or help people appreciate the poems, and how image has impacted you, Any images or any movies or any kind of visual arts or paintings have impacted you, and kind of thinking imagistically about your work. Maybe comment a little bit on that. Yeah.
Yeah, I and it, to be honest, almost all of my inspiration visually like that from imagery is Frida. I mean,
Yeah.
she, I, everything around my house has a Frida image, or because it's yeah, that's where I go to. I have a studio down the ways down the drive, and she is everywhere. And if I am lacking and I feel like I need a connection or I'm gonna drown, I just sit down and look at her. And Frida takes me where I need to be. And that's why when the poetry box chose that cover for my chapbook, I was so excited. I mean, it was something like she would have designed, right? I mean, it was very Frida. And
Yeah.
I was just super excited when I saw it. I didn't even look at anything else that she was suggesting. I just saw that one. I said, that's it.
Yeah. But also about if you talk a little bit about like your relationship with divine or any religious influence you've had over the years, and anything you want to say on your relationship with, it feels like there's an undercurrent of spirituality through your poetry. So I want you to comment a little bit on your spiritual upbringing and bring that into the picture a little bit.
Sure. My religious upbringing was very defined. I went to Catholic school from kindergarten to 10th grade, and I graduated in 10th grade. I had enough religion in me to last me several lifetimes. Not the, I mean, I'm not going to put down Catholicism, but it was hard. It was a critical thing, and it was hard, and it was hard to debate within systems that I was not quite entirely sure I understood or believe in. But let's be honest, I train as a scientist. I'm extremely scientifically minded, but there has been enough things happening in my life to know that there is another realm, that if you connect to that realm, you get blessed. And I have been blessed so many times when I have allowed myself to be connected, that my scientific mind cannot make sense out of it. Because there have been things that are just beyond believable. And, but there's, to me, there are proofs of this reality that we might not acknowledge, but when we do, we receive blessing in abundance. Does that's where I stand on spirituality.
You consider poetry one of your bridges between the scientific and the spiritual?
What was that, Jessica?
Would you consider poetry one of your bridges between the spiritual and the scientific?
That's what I, yes, in a way, that's what I attempt to do. Like in this new collection of Hollow Bones, that beauty of our flying dinosaurs connect to the spiritual realm in very concrete ways with our own reality, I think. And maybe that's the, we can't define it. We can't take a photograph of it. The best thing we can do is try to put a collection of words together to get that impression of that link.
It's interesting, like when you're talking about poetry writing and spirituality and getting a connection to the divine energy. And then at the same time, where, to what extent does meditation or a contemplative path has that inflicted? I like the idea of bringing forth what is some what have you moved into? Because you're saying you're kind of moving away from or moving away. What have you moved towards in the in current times now? What are some of your practices that you do currently to connect with the divine? Do you have any particular like disciplines you do or routines you do in writing?
The main one is I usually when I start, I try to open myself, and I have some people don't have self affirmations. I actually do something that is a little bit different. I usually say, allow my arrogance to dissipate away from me. Allow my humbleness to open free. And I think that has been, for me, a real good conduit to where I want to be. I think for many years, especially in my 20s and 30s, I was so arrogant, and then nothing good was going to come out of it that. And it was not until I realized, take your arrogance, mask, throw it away, let the humbleness be in. Let the truth be in. And I wish I was like Dr. Jessica and did more yoga, and but I haven't been able to. I really do want to do yoga, but
But you do, I believe you do some poetry prompts. Is that right? Do you give your mailing list some poetry prompts? Is
oh
that,
yeah.
yeah, if you tell us a little bit about that, and then we're starting to wind down, but we tell us a little bit about
Sure.
the prompts.
And I think that's part of allowing the universe to open to you is like if I have a successful writing day and I realize that I understand where the poem comes from, I try to make it as a prompt and send it to my friends. I send it in my private mail, but I also do a lot of classes that I teach and try to do as many prompts as possible because I think that is the gift. The gift is the sharing, the allowing others to be able to do the same connections, to free them and to put them out, and then you can get the benefits of reading them.
Thank you. Thank you. So once again, this is Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm your host, Vijay Nathan. And we have Jessica Mehta, PhD, Dr. Jessica Mehta, and Amelia Diaz-Ettinger. I just want to remind people that there's going to be an independent music communities on the 5th annual New Colossus Festival, a 5-day showcase festival taking place March 6th to March 10th at 8 independent music venues in the Lower East Side. This year's festival will feature over 130 emerging artists from all around the world, as well as Ditto X, NYC 24 music conference and networking events. Be sure to swing by Arlene's Grocery on Wednesday, March 6th, for the New Colossus Festival Welcome Party, presented by yours truly, Radio Free Brooklyn. Information regarding badges and show schedules can be found at www.newcolossusfestival.com. It's going to be March 11th or March 6th to the 10th. Is going to be the actual independent music venues on the Lower East Side. So please check that out. So we have about a few more minutes, about 5 minutes. We can do some closing thoughts. And then we might play a song at the end if we're a few minutes off. We'll play a song at the end, which Amelia will choose of her choosing. So we'll close out any closing out. Thanks so much for being here. Thank you so much for your insights. And I'll let Dr. Jessica go ahead.
This was amazing. Thank you for joining. I don't know what's up with my audio. It will be better next time. I do have a super quick question for Amelia. If you can think off the top of your head, what's one of your favorite prompts? And maybe we or listeners can follow it too.
Actually, one of my favorite prompts is not mine, is from Beth Piatot, which is a magnificent poet from California, is where in your body do you carry your sacred water? And I love that prompt. Partly because of the self-decision where in our bodies we carry different things, but where in your body you hold the sacred water. I think that's a good prompt.
Absolutely. And I appreciate it because I think recently we are, where in your body do you hold something that we consider negative? And this inverts it. So it's the sacred.
Yeah,
Thank you.
especially in some therapeutic models, they'd be like, where do you feel the pain? And then release it. But it's good to also acknowledge that we're holding that value. Yeah, holding that value that we need to also tap into the energy. So thank you so much. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you for having me. This was great fun. It was great to meet you and lovely to see you.
Thanks so much, guys. All right, so we'll see you next week at Sunday at 7 a.m. We'll be airing on Radio Free Brooklyn, but of course, we're going to be archiving both on the Radio Free Brooklyn archive, radiofreebrooklyn.org/truth-to-power. You'll find the archives. This is like 230 episode, number 230 episode. But you can find our previous episodes when we were airing between 2017 and 2022. Then I took a little break and then restarted. But people can find out a little bit more about the show at radiofreebrooklyn.org/truth-to-power. So have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Voy a escuchar el silencio.